All rise. The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Well, good afternoon to you all. For our third case of the day, State versus Fuerte, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Justices, and may it please the court, my name is Lisa Comfer, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. Your Honors, the Duang-Mala decision incorrectly interpreted 971.082 in isolation and did not harmonize it with the harmless error statute. That has led to an absurd result that allows defendants to test the waters at sentencing and withdraw their pleas based upon an error that caused them no harm. And the United States Supreme Court decision in Padilla versus Kentucky has swept away any rationale for continuing to adhere to doing
counsel in the state's view, was there anything that the circuit court judge omitted? And I know I've read the your opposing counsel's briefs, that, and I know that oftentimes the colloquy, the elements of the colloquy are divided up into three parts. I sometimes wonder, though, if deportation and exclusion from this country don't about cover it. And denial of naturalization, I'm not quite sure I know what that means, but between the two, deportation and exclusion from readmission into this country, many people might say that about sums it up. But I wonder from the state's perspective if there's anything really missing from the circuit court's recitation to Mr. Fuerte.
Yes, Justice Gableman, the state is conceding that the circuit court here did not follow the statutory mandate. The Wisconsin courts have acknowledged that the circuit court does not have to follow the statutory language exactly and can make some small deviations, but all of the case law up until this point has determined that substantial compliance requires that the circuit court list all three possible immigration consequences. The state is not contesting that the circuit court left out one of the consequences when it gave Mr. Reyes-Fuerte his immigration warning. However, all of the other courts around the country who have similar statutes almost uniformly have determined, even if they say, much like Wisconsin, that the circuit court is required to give people these warnings in fairly exact language, almost all of the other states also say that if you are not challenging the specific consequence that the circuit court left out, then you received an adequate warning. And Wisconsin does not even do that. And that is one of the reasons that the state is asking this court to revisit the Duang-Mala decision, because it simply has led to this absurd result where people are able to withdraw their pleas based upon a flaw that did not have any effect on them whatsoever.
Counsel, could I ask you three questions? One, is the subject of the removal proceeding, that is, why this particular defendant was the subject of deportation, is that in the record anywhere? Because it was going on at the time that he entered his pleas.
Yes. Now, when you say subject of the proceeding,
why was he being removed?
That is not in the record.
Okay. That was my question. I just wanted to know if I missed it somewhere because I looked for it and couldn't find it. Second, Lee versus United States came out at the end of June last year. How, if at all, does that impact your argument? Maybe it doesn't, but I just wanted to make sure that counsel weren't later going to say, gosh, we just came across this case. It really isn't in our briefing, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk about it if you wanted to. And then another thing I would like you to address is this idea of after the fact, being able to challenge something. Because here, what difference does it really make? And I know the judge didn't give word for word verbatim recitation of the statute. But even if he would have, wouldn't this particular defendant be able to raise the same challenge? Because it really amounts to, as I see it, after he entered a plea, after he was sentenced, the Seventh Circuit came down with a decision that impacted his ability to defend himself in the removal proceeding. So why shouldn't he, even if the judge gave it right, why shouldn't he be able to say, look, I want to withdraw my plea, and here's why, because it took away my valid defense, or my defense that I could have raised in that removal proceeding?
Well, I think the answer to that question, Justice Ziegler, is that the purpose of the immigration warning is not to give defendants an automatic out if they later find out that their plea is going to result in immigration consequences. The purpose of the statute is to ensure that defendants are entering their pleas with full knowledge that their plea could result in immigration consequences. So the fact that this may have later, and I don't think there's anything in the record either that really definitively explains whether or not this cancellation of removal should qualify as something that would make him likely or not likely to be deported. If you look up the immigration statutes, that is a very, very limited exception. I think it's something like 4,000 people per year who apply for it are actually granted it.
Well, what changed was he pled guilty and was sentenced to a crime that previously wasn't deemed a crime of moral turpitude. Then the Seventh Circuit decided the case, and it was, and that impacted his ability to defend in the removal proceedings.
Yes.
So with that, why would it make any difference? I mean, it almost seems like a technicality that the judge said two out of the three things. It's pretty clear, it seems, from the record that he's not making an ineffective assistance of counsel argument. So we're really left with, should he be able to withdraw his plea because a defense that he might have once had available to him in the removal proceeding is now gone because of the Seventh Circuit decision that now defines the crime to which he pled as a crime of moral turpitude?
I think that would have to be addressed by the circuit court, Your Honor. The problem here is we have absolutely no knowledge of what Reyes Fuerte knew when he was going into this plea. We don't know if he was told of immigration consequences. We don't know if they were explained to him. And we have.
Well, the proceeding was pending. I mean, at the time he entered this plea, he knew he was the subject of a removal proceeding. So it can't be a big surprise to him that he might be deported, excluded from admission, or denied naturalization because he was the subject, right, of removal proceedings.
Yes.
So he was in it at the time he entered his plea and sentencing. The change is this Seventh Circuit opinion that changed whether he had a defense in the removal proceeding. All right, let's move it out of that context. To what extent, if a case comes out and is deciding it would have helped someone, when can they withdraw their plea and when can't they?
I think in that situation, Justice Ziegler, what we have here is that would be something that it would go towards Reyes Fuerte's knowledge of whether he was actually facing deportation consequences because of this plea, because the Lee decision did indeed define the crime to which he pled as a crime of moral turpitude, and perhaps he had a reason to think that that might be the case beforehand. Perhaps it didn't. But
Lee's different from the Seventh Circuit opinion. Lee's a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's an ineffective assistance of counsel case, but anyway.
Apart from the case, and forgive me for that, what I meant to say was the Seventh Circuit case that defined his crime as a crime of moral turpitude obviously had not come down yet when Reyes Fuerte pled to this, but that would go to his knowledge, And if you were to adopt what the state is asking you to adopt here and allow for the state to prove when someone does not get the full immigration warning that they otherwise knew that their plea could result in immigration consequences, then that will be a problem for Mr. Reyes-Fuerte because he will have a hearing at which he can say, we have new case law. I had no reason to know when I entered this plea that this was going to be defined as a crime of moral turpitude. And in that case, yes, if he didn't actually know that and it's going to lead to his inability to defend against this, then he absolutely would be able to withdraw his plea. So in this particular situation, it seems like Mr. Reyes-Fuerte may have plenty of options, but what the state is asking this court to adopt here is a reasonable interpretation of this statute that takes into account two other statutes that
Let me just back up, and then I'll leave you alone on this and let someone else have their chance. But so let's say, I mean, what about the other defendants who, you know, When law changes after they've been subject to a proceeding, at what point can you always come back and challenge your conviction and withdraw your plea? Is there ever a time when, you know, after the fact the law changed and you're stuck with what the law was at the time you pled and were sentenced?
The way that this court thus far has interpreted this statute, there is no limitation to that. And that is another reason the state is asking that this court require some kind of knowledge requirement.
What I'm trying to do is weigh and balance that considering how any other defendant would be treated if after the fact the law changed regarding a conviction. Can they always come back and challenge a conviction based upon the fact that law, a case in one circuit, later changed the law?
That depends on the circumstances of the individual defendant's case, Justice Ziegler. If there was some large constitutional principle that was new and there was no reason to foresee that came down from the United States Supreme Court, then absolutely a defendant could bring a 974-06 motion and they would not be barred by any prior post-conviction motions or any direct appeal that they had taken before that. That's very well established in Wisconsin that new law doesn't subject you to any kind of procedural bar if you can show that it is actually something that would fall under that particular motion procedure. And under this particular motion procedure, we simply have no limiting principle at the moment.
Counsel, if I may, are you finished, Justice Ziegler?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me you're arguing about the limiting principle, i.e. time-limiting principle. I want clarification of two areas. Number one, a recent response that you just made to Justice Ziegler, and number two, your position in this case regarding substantial compliance and remedy. I'll start with the first. I understood you to say, in response to Justice Ziegler, if he did not know of the defense, quote, then he absolutely could withdraw his plea. Is that your position?
If the circuit court found that he truly did not know that this plea could lead to these deportation consequences because it's going to eliminate this defense.
Because it's a crime of moral turpitude.
Because it's a crime of moral turpitude. It has become a crime of moral turpitude. If he did not know that when he entered this plea, then, or he had no reason to know that when he entered this plea, and the circuit court finds that he had no reason to know that when he entered this plea, and he can show that that is likely to result in his deportation, then yes, he would absolutely get to withdraw his plea.
So,
are you sure that you want to concede that?
I mean, that seems like
that's pretty big concession.
Absolutely is probably the wrong word. If that series of events took place, where this was remanded to the circuit court and we said, okay, you have to show that you are going to be, you're going to have to meet the statute and you're also going to have to show that you didn't know this when you entered your plea.
You didn't know that it would become subsequently. I mean, how is anyone going to know that?
Well, of course he is not going to know specifically that it's going to become that something else, but in most of the constitutional law cases, we often say that you reach a point where it's either a new rule or it's not. And if you were able to discern it from prior precedent, then it's not a new rule. And I would think something similar would probably apply in this situation, where if it was reasonably foreseeable that some circuit somewhere was going to define this crime as a crime of moral turpitude or an aggravated felony, then yes, you probably would have a reason to know that when you entered your plea. But a change in the law, if it's truly a new change in the law, then yes, no one would really have a reason to anticipate or know that when they entered their plea.
The second area that I said I wanted clarification on is in part of your argument regarding substantial compliance. As I understand it now, the state is advancing and conceding that there was not substantial compliance with 97108, and that the state, in its reply brief, page 6, asks for this remedy, to remand the circuit court for an evidentiary hearing to permit the state to prove that the defendant's plea was knowing, intelligent, voluntary, despite any violation of 97108(1)(c). Is my understanding correct of your position?
Yes, Justice Bradley, that's the state's position. Essentially, the state is just asking this court to treat this like any other Bangert claim, where if the person can show up, you know, that the court failed to give them this immigration warning, and they say that they didn't otherwise know that, then the court must hold an evidentiary hearing where the burden shifts to the state to prove that, yes, the person did otherwise know of these immigration consequences and that they could result from the plea.
Is the state, in effect, is asking the court to change its decision in State versus Duong-Mala?
Yes, Justice Abrahamson. The state is asking this court to overturn Duong-Mala.
And that was a decision on basis of statutory interpretation.
Yes.
And since that case, the statute has not changed.
That's correct.
And the usual rule is that if there's a statutory interpretation and the interpretation has not been changed by the legislature, adopting a new statute, then the court does not overturn or change that decision unless you can show it was wrong. Right?
Yes.
I mean, that's the general rule. But you're asking this court to overturn a statutory interpretation decision, despite the fact that it's been, that interpretation has been in effect for what, more than 10 years?
Yes, Justice Abrahamson, I believe it's 15 years.
Okay, that's more than 10.
Yeah.
There's no showing here that it was wrong as a matter of statutory interpretation.
Well, the state believes that it was wrong as a matter of
I know that, but what's its basis for that?
The basis for that is the Duong-Mala decision did not make any attempt to harmonize three statutes that all have mandatory language. In fact, they all have the same mandatory language that Duong-Mala decided the case upon. They all say that the court shall do something. We've got 805.181, which says that the court shall, in every stage of an action, disregard any error or defect in the proceedings or pleadings which shall not affect the substantial rights of the adverse party. And then we also have 971.26 that says no judgment shall be affected by any defect or imperfection in matters of form that do not prejudice the defendant. So read together, these three statutes create an ambiguity, and it is, when that's the case, as this court recognized in Inree Gilbert, it is this court's duty to harmonize the statutes, not ignore one section while enforcing another.
So your premise is that we always have to try to harmonize. I mean, I reread the Duong-Mala case a couple of times in preparation for today. I saw in your argument that you didn't harmonize. And when I think of three-part harmony here. You know, you got three statutes going on. Duong-Mala said you have the 97108(1)(c), you have 97, which is you shall advise the defendant of, etc. You have the 971082, which is the remedy for failure of the circuit court to give that warning. And then you have, under Duong-Mala, 97126, which is the harmless error statute. And then the opinion goes through each one, starts out with the first, of course, that I just mentioned, then goes to the second, and then sets forth 971-26, the harmless error, sets forth it in text, explains for several paragraphs the Chavez case that came to a different conclusion than Dwayne Mala with regard to harmless error, and concludes that the Chavez interpretation is clearly wrong, plainly wrong, I guess, was the language. And so it's not like it doesn't deal with harmless error. Several times it cites to it. It sets it forth. It discusses it. It discusses it vis-a-vis primarily with regard to Chavez, but also, I think, Lopez and Garcia. And so when a court says, we've looked at this stuff, we've analyzed it, it's wrong, I don't think we're bound to then try to engage in harmonizing. I mean, I don't think that's some kind of an our hands are so tied that we have, see how tight they are? Our hands are so tied that as a matter of law, the court can't decide something is just plainly wrong, out in left field or right field or whatever field you want. Are you saying we always have to? We're bound by that?
To the extent that inconsistent statutes can be harmonized by giving in a way that gives effect to both of them, yes, this court is bound by the legislature writing both of those statutes,
sure.
And the court is bound by its duty to interpret them in a way that gives effect to both of them. The problem with the analysis that the Dwayne Mala decision undertook is that it only looked to the legislative history, which the court rightly recognized was not extremely illuminating in that case. All that the legislative history said, we had a couple of drafting notes, and as the court recognized, it's not clear that that was ever the purpose for the statute or that anyone ever saw it. It was simply what was given to the LRB to ask them to draft the statute. However, when you have two potentially inconsistent statutes and you can give them a construction that gives effect to both of them and avoids an unreasonable or absurd result, as we have here, where someone can withdraw a plea based on something that caused them no harm, it's this court's duty to give the statutes that construction. And the court in Dwayne Mala simply didn't do that.
Well, it focused really, although it touched upon legislative intent, it said that Chavez and its interpretation of harmless error rule and its application, that it was objectively wrong under the language of the statute. It really focused on the shall language and noted, hey, this is something real unusual, which it is. The legislature not only said shall, then they put quotation marks. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen that after shall before. Quotation marks of you shall give this. Now, I know our case law says you can be a little loose on that. But, I mean, it's putting quotation marks kind of says, and we really mean it, I think. And so that was the focus, really, of Dwayne Mala. This language, buttressed by legislative history, but the language is pretty clear. Respond if you disagree with that focus.
I disagree to an extent with that focus, Justice Bradley, because we have another statute that also says the court shall. And in that situation, even if the Dwayne Mala court found the legislative history unpersuasive, the court was bound to find a way to reconcile these statutes. And part of that means going to the context and the history of why there was the court shall vacate the plea in that statute. And in the Dwayne Mala decision, that is never discussed. And there's a very good reason why there is a provision in that statute that says the court shall vacate the plea. And that's because for a very long time, and up until the Padilla decision, there was absolutely no question about whether or not this was true. Immigration consequences were always considered collateral consequences of conviction. And therefore, even if the legislature would have written this statute and said, Circuit Court, you have to say these words to a person, if they would not have put a remedy provision in that statute, there would have been no remedy for that, because what the court would have said was, Well, this was simply a failure to understand collateral consequences of conviction. It did not render your plea unknowing and involuntary, and then a person would not have been able to withdraw their plea on that basis. That is why there is a remedy provision in that statute, because even if the legislature at the time that it wrote this statute would have said, Circuit Court, you have to say this, if they would not have put a plea withdrawal remedy in there, there would not have been a remedy at all. And given the context in which that statute was written, against that background, it simply doesn't make any sense to assume that this legislature intended this not to be treated like every other claim for plea withdrawal, and for there to be some knowledge or prejudice component to it. With the context and the history of the background of the law against which this was written, it doesn't make any sense to interpret it that way. And the Duang-Mala decision simply did not undergo that analysis. It looked directly to the legislative history, decided that was unpersuasive, and then just said, this statute says shall, so we're not going to talk about the other statutes, and that's...
So don't you believe in a textual analysis?
This is still a textual analysis, Justice Abrahamson. But when you have statutes that may be giving conflicting directives to the circuit court.
What's conflicting about this? In this statute, it is a subsection 2 that particularly says what the results will be. That's a specific statute. You're relying on a general statute to take precedence. In addition to that, as you present the issue your brief, now the criminal defense attorneys are obligated to advise their clients about immigration consequences under Padilla should the Wisconsin Supreme Court overturn its decision in Duang-Mala. Just the statement of the issue is a real problem for you, because Duang-Mala is a state statute, and there's no argument that that state statute is unconstitutional under Padilla. So Duang-Mala, as a state statute, does not have to adopt Padilla, as long as it doesn't conflict with it. Does it conflict with Padilla?
No, Justice Abrahamson.
Okay. So it can survive. And that's what this case held on state statute. And you want us to overturn a construction, an interpretation of a state statute that has lasted over 10 years. The state has not, as far as I know, gone to the legislature and asked them to overturn Duang-Mala or change the statutes. And you want us to change a state statutory interpretation on the basis of a federal constitutional case, and our interpretation doesn't violate the Constitution. Where do you get sense out of that?
I see my red light is on. May I briefly answer?
Yes, please answer.
The state should have been clearer in its briefing, Justice Abrahamson. What the state was trying to say was it always has asserted that Duang-Mala was wrongly decided. However, the Padilla decision just erased all of the background assumptions against which Duang-Mala was decided. Coming to the writing the statute,
assuming
everyone...
It doesn't erase the assumptions under which that case was decided. It may erase assumptions under
the
which...
The red light is on. She was answering your question. And now I ask the Chief Justice to enforce the red light as she's been doing all day.
Please finish your answer.
Under which the legislation...
Just answer the original question.
It's the state's position that because of Padilla, defendants no longer come to the table with absolutely no knowledge, and we should stop assuming that they do. And that is why we're asking this court to revisit Duang-Mala at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask, if I may, when you come back...
Justice
Gableman, please just a minute, okay? I appreciate your help very much, but I'm able to manage.
You had a question that
you wanted her to address on rebuttal.
That's correct.
Please tell her what it is.
Thank you. Given that Padilla is ineffective assistance of counsel, and your sense that now that's altered the horizons, how does that affect your request to change Duang-Mala? How does that affect pro se defendants?
Okay, she'll address those and others your questions you have on rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Ben Krause, and I represent Jose Alberto Reyes Fuerte. This case is about the Wisconsin legislature's ability to dictate actual words spoken in courtrooms throughout this state. The Attorney General's broad interpretation of the harmless error rule would greatly undermine the Wisconsin legislature's ability to do exactly that. And the plain language of Wisconsin Statute Section 97108 cannot support such a reading. And when this court interpreted Wisconsin Statute Section 97108 in conjunction with 971.26, the harmless error rule, it concluded that the language led inexorably toward one conclusion.
Counselor, I never saw that harmless error statute mentioned. You want to point where in Duganmala that statute is mentioned?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, Your Honor, but the issue there was the harmless error.
I put it to you that the statute is not mentioned. Well, okay.
In paragraph 10.
Okay. The statute on harmless error. Please go ahead.
Paragraph 3.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. We don't need to argue among ourselves, although we seem to be unable to avoid it today.
Can I maybe talk to you a little bit about harmless error?
Oh, please.
All right. That's where you were headed, right? Or were you not done?
I wasn't done, but
okay,
please
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
In Duganmala, the harmless error analysis really was that there should be no harmless error analysis.
Right.
I think that's exactly right, Justice.
That's correct.
Okay. So there wasn't a typical harmless error analysis. It was really an analysis that you can't engage in harmless error analysis, right?
That's exactly right.
At the time that case was decided, we still had the statute that required the judge to act, or it could be vacated. And we had the competing statutes dealing with, you know, if something goes wrong, it's generally subject to a harmless error analysis. So typically, you might try to fit those together and see if they can be read together and make sense. I guess when I read that case, I just think there was error. Why do you think the court went so far as to engage in this harmless error, the fact that you can't even engage in harmless error? The court clearly found error, right? The court clearly didn't think it was harmless. So why in the world do you think the court went so far to decide an issue that was much broader than that necessary before it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Are you referring to the actual Supreme Court decision in Duganmala,
why
the court ended up reaching the conclusion that the harmless error did not apply?
It seems to be an issue that is parallel, but really not seminal to the decision in the case, because clearly the court didn't do it right. At the time that case was decided, you didn't have Padilla and the cases that provided additional safeguards. So what you had was a court not doing it right and our court saying he can withdraw his plea.
Yeah, and I think the reason why we're...
And ineffective assistance. So with those things all lined up, and here we don't have ineffective assistance, and we have Padilla, which now provides additional safeguards to the defendant. So why isn't it time to take a look?
Well, I think first thing I want to disentangle the Padilla remedy from the remedy under 97108. And I think one important thing that's come up in the questions toward the state is just how complicated the analysis is in how a defendant is harmed in a 97108 motion. Because not only do you have to have a pretty detailed understanding of immigration law to understand the nature of the harm suffered. In this case, Mr. Fuerte Reyes lost the ability to apply for a discretionary form of relief in a different court under federal law. And he did so pursuant to a case that was decided only months later. And so I think trying to get at the precise understanding of a defendant when he entered into that courtroom is particularly problematic in this case. And that's why the remedy under Padilla is not fully overlapping with the remedy described in 97108 sub 2.
Do you see what I was saying when counsel was up here, though? What you're really asking for is almost like ex post facto relief. Regardless, I mean, everyone in the world could have given the right warnings, but given that Seventh Circuit case, that's what took away, you're saying, the possibility of the defense, because this crime is now labeled as something it wasn't before.
And I think that's exactly what we are asking for, Justice Ziegler. I think that there is an ameliorative nature to 97108 sub 2 that doesn't necessarily just take into account the frame of mind of the defendant the moment they come into the court. The automatic remedy of 97108 sub 2 has that power and doesn't need to explore that temporal aspect of what they knew and when. And I think that comes out of the plain language of the statute. And I think that there are really two strong reasons in the statute itself for concluding that the defendant's mental state is not at issue. And I think the first one is the one that the court addressed earlier, the word shall and the quotation marks, the mandatory language. I think the word shall, the mandatory language there, anticipates discretionary pushback from a court. Courts want to enforce the decisions and judgments that they've made as final with good reason. And the word shall anticipates, in my opinion, that discretionary pushback in defense of finality. And that's exactly what... So in my mind, the word shall speaks directly to 971.26 and speaks directly to 805.18. And it says, we know that there will be a pushback, but we're saying you need to vacate the conviction anyway because the consequences of a conviction in state court can be extremely harsh under federal law, as they would be here for Mr. Fuerte-Reyes, who has children born here in the United States and faces separation forever from them in the United States. And we see this a lot in our office. So I think there is certainly a reluctance to grant an automatic remedy, a fear of windfalls and a fear of disturbing finality of court decisions. And I think that this court is justified in examining very closely the statute and the justifications for why we think that's necessary.
Okay, but I'm going to push you on this a little bit because I hear your argument, and your argument, you're saying because the court didn't do it right, he gets to have his plea vacated. But what you're also saying is it really has nothing to do with that. It's because he now is deprived of a defense that had he known the Seventh Circuit would have decided this case that way, he wouldn't have entered his plea, right?
That's right.
So it's kind of sideways with the notion of, it's just, I mean, the court not saying the words right is not necessarily relevant to your real argument, which is, this case deprived him, you believe, of his defense in the pending. I mean, this is not the situation like in Duang Mala or some of the others where the person really didn't know. And they were maybe even told, you're not going to be subject to deportation, removal, denial. They're given incorrect information or not told that there are warnings. I mean, he knew at the time he entered the plea that he was the subject of removal proceedings. You can't come in and say, gosh, he had no idea he could have been deported. I mean, you just can't make that argument like they can in the other cases. So this is a little sideways with those. So then, you know, when you think through it, really what the argument you're making is it's the Seventh Circuit case, not the judge's failure to warn, that changed everything.
Well, it's the plea that changed everything. It's the plea that made him now subject to, or now ineligible to be convicted.
No, he was subject to the removal proceedings before he entered the plea. And do you agree that what the basis of that was is not part of the record?
I agree that the actual charging document issued by the government was not a part of the record at the time. It did not make it into the federal court right now. That's true.
Is that public record? Is it?
It is, and I have since obtained the documents, but at the time of filing the initial motion, I hadn't yet gotten access to those documents.
Okay.
But if I may briefly push back a little, Your Honor, my 19108 is also about the importance of a court fully fulfilling its duties, and the power and the force of the court stating specific text to a respondent in the moment of that plea hearing, and whether that would actually change the defendant's mind and make him withdraw his plea in that moment, or if he'd have the presence of mind to even respond that quickly, I think is a question more for the legislature to consider if they decide to modify this language or this statute, the effectiveness of it in changing defendant's mind. But I think that that really gets more at policy considerations that are better placed in the legislature if the Attorney General does want to take this up with them.
Isn't this really a way of getting at an issue that has been in these cases in concurrence or dissents in separate opinions, namely that there should be a time limit for raising these issues? And there's none in the statute, and the court has never adopted a time in that. Can raise at any time, and that at any time you can make the defense that the statute gives them. Isn't that your point?
I think so, Your Honor. And if I understand your point correctly, I guess I'd respond by saying that there is no obvious requirement for a time limit. In fact, there's the opposite. The way 971.08(2) is written, it describes a nexus, a sort of causal nexus between the plea and adverse immigration consequences. And those adverse immigration consequences are always sometime far downstream. You know, Justice Gableman referred to naturalization. That's a benefit that an individual who's already a green card holder might seek years after holding their green card, and upon a showing of good moral character can become a United States citizen. And those sorts of applications are necessarily so far downstream of criminal convictions that I think that placing a temporal limitation on exactly when a defendant can file a motion like this would frustrate the causal nexus element of 971.08(2). So no, I don't believe that there is a time element described in the statute, and I don't believe that this court should impose one.
And then when I asked about that, counsel, your opposing counsel responded by saying that has no application to this case. Do you agree?
I would agree that the defendant is not currently eligible to apply for naturalization. He's currently here with no legal status and is defending himself against being removed. So he would be far removed from an application for naturalization.
And so what would your response be to the idea that she further sketched out, which would be to say that she is unaware of any other state that would say that the omission of such a warning, which is not applicable to the defendant who is hearing the warnings from the circuit court judge, would not have any applicability in an appeal such as this?
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't give a particularly helpful response, just not being aware of all of the other statutes that have been cited. I wouldn't know how closely they track the language here in Wisconsin. I think this argument that we're making today is very statutory and very based on the language itself. And so I would feel uncomfortable, and I apologize, Justice Gableman,
no,
for not knowing this offhand.
That's fair enough, and I appreciate your candor. And in response to your candor, I'll give you the gift of my candor, which is this. You started your argument this afternoon by saying this case, if we do anything other than tell the circuit court judge that he was wrong, then we have interfered with the legislature's ability to, and this is your word, dictate what our circuit court judges may say in their courtrooms. Now, having been a circuit court judge for 6 years and also being very concerned about the separation of powers, that had all the appeal to me of fingernails on a chalkboard. First of all, we won't even get into the separation of powers because that's not an issue in this case. What it does implicate for me, though, that I think is at issue in this case is we in this room, the seven of us and the rotating cast of characters that has comprised the seven of us that have occupied these seats, to the best of my knowledge, has never demanded, expected, or required of our circuit court judges a perfect parroting of the legislative dictated language. We are informed by the knowledge that our circuit court judges are human beings. And like every other human being on the face of the planet, including all of those gathered in this room today, They make mistakes. The question is, what mistakes are bad enough to warrant a reversal of everything that had gone before and up to and including their conduct? Conversely, what conduct do they engage in that is not a perfect recitation of what the legislature has set forth, mindful and being informed of the savings statute we have that say perfect compliance is not expected, given the legislature? I'm unaware of any perfect legislators either. If you are, please let me know. It would be interesting. Given their recognition that nobody is perfect, they have quite logically and quite sensibly provided two different savings statutes that says we don't expect perfect compliance with these things. Substantial compliance where all of the material factors have been covered is good enough. And when I read the transcript of what the circuit court judge informed your client, I thought, is that the prettiest recitation I've ever seen, the most eloquent, the most substantive, the most substantial? No. Have I probably, as a circuit court judge, and maybe even on this bench, have I always been a poet? In my questions and my statements, of course not. So we really hone in on the issue of what is good enough. So this whole thing about we interfere with the dictating of what the legislature makes our circuit court judges say, that's for us. And the legislature isn't going to dictate anything without our approval. And our approval is going to depend on what is substantially fair enough, what is reasonable enough. And I'm trying to think to myself, what in this case was insubstantial and unfair about the warning your client received? And if we take the issue of naturalization off the table because it didn't comply to it, or it didn't apply to them, what do we have left?
What we have left is another of several errors that were committed by the trial court in this case. And I guess to begin with, I would like to talk about what the trial court did say in this case. And I think it is important.
I'm sorry. As I've had to explain to two other sets of lawyers today, I have two ear infections. Both ear canals are almost entirely closed off. I've had good luck in that I've been able to hear their voices.
I'll speak up.
You also speak very quickly. Extent you can. Thanks.
So we'll start with the transcripts and talk about the exact things that I believe were said incorrectly on the record. And I think there are really two major substantive legal errors. And one was the omission of the mentioning of naturalization. And the other was conflating citizenship with residency. And in this case, the judge referred to a resident, which a reasonable or untrained legal mind may construe to be someone who simply lives here. In other words, if you weren't paying close attention, I think you could easily dismiss this advisal by thinking, well, I'm a resident, I don't have anything to worry about here. I'm not saying that's what Mr. Reyes, what they did here. But I think both of those things, both of those errors get it in a lot of ways a larger point. I think in that moment, what the trial court needs to be doing is blowing up any plea deal that's not been properly thought out from an immigration standpoint. And instead of reading the advisal as it was written in the strong language that the legislature gave the court, it took a number of other steps to sort of sugarcoat the advisal. I think a lot of times courts believe that the two attorneys representing the defendant and the state have probably reached a common sense good resolution that works in this case. and they don't want to blow up that deal. And so they'll say things like, I'm not saying this is going to apply to you. Or instead of using the word deportation, say
you have you have a good eye. I caught that too.
So thank you. And so I think even if those are not failures to substantially comply, and those were not the points seized on by the court below, instead the court took a more formalistic approach and said, you know, did the court mention naturalization? Did the court mention deportation in the general sense? And it focused instead on those sort of formal cues, the four or the three main consequences in some other language. But I think there are also smaller errors that are also relevant in this case. And I hope that answers your question.
When I'm listening to you answer, Justice Gableman, what I hear your, and just correct me if I'm wrong, your argument is that the court did not follow the statutory language to the T, and for that reason alone, this plea should be withdrawn.
Yes, with the caveat that I think the Court of Appeals properly interpreted 97108 to permit only substantial compliance.
So the Seventh Circuit case is not what you're basing your argument on.
Well, the Seventh Circuit case creates or helps guide, or helps bring us to the causal nexus, I think, between his conviction and his deportation.
But those are two separate things. So I just need to know, are you basing it on the language not being done properly, and because of that, in and of itself, regardless of if he knew, he could face deportation without a defense even maybe, but regardless of what he knew or what his counsel told him or what was in the form and the partial admonition that the court gave him, the court's deficiency in and of itself under existing case law is enough to withdraw the plea.
That's exactly what I am arguing.
Okay. So I needed to button that up for myself, because what I had thought you might be doing was say, and even if you found that that was good, hey, the law changed, and it changed pretty quickly afterward, and so that in and of itself, had he known that at the time, because the court wasn't going to say, you know, this isn't a crime of moral turpitude, or it is a crime of moral turpitude, and here's how it goes down, and here's what your defense would be. I mean, a trial court is not going to be doing that. So I'm trying to figure out, so really the Seventh Circuit case is not the basis? It's just you're sort of informing us on what the defense could have been?
Exactly. The way I look at it, maybe I'm not understanding your question properly, but the way I look at it, there are two separate elements to this motion. And the first element comes to how good was the advisal? And the second element that's completely different is, does that lead to a causal nexus with an adverse immigration consequence?
Yeah, but the judge, had the judge given absolutely perfect warnings, would you be making the arguments you're making now?
Absolutely not. No, Your Honor.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about harmless error that I did try to do when we started out. The statute for harmless error is mentioned once, but it's never talked about in the entire Duganmala decision. And the reason I'm concerned about that is that's basically the state's argument on why we ought to overrule Duganmala. Not that there wasn't an error there. I think everyone agrees there certainly was. So I'd like you to tell me, is there a way of harmonizing the harmless error statute and our opinion in Duganmala as we interpreted the statute on deportation and warnings in that regard?
No, Judge, I don't see a way to properly harmonize the broad statute of harmless error or 805.18. I don't see a way to harmonize either one of those with 97108 sub 2. And one of the reasons I don't see it is because I think that those would read out the second of the two elements I was just discussing with Justice Ziegler. I think if you have to show that an individual will be, that causal nexus element, that an individual will be deported or denied naturalization or excluded from the United States, then that is the prejudice element. It doesn't get at mental state, but it is already an element. And it would be completely eliminated by the harmless error rule, which was in existence at the time the statute was passed. So I think the short answer is I think there's no way to truly reconcile those elements, because the harmless error rule would read out one entire element of that motion. And although that wasn't addressed in the court's original decision in Duangmala, I think that's another reason to support the holding today.
Okay, thank you. That's what I wanted to know.
As I understand it, both you and the state are acknowledging that there or are advancing that there wasn't substantial compliance with the statute here. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
I asked that the state respond to a question regarding pro se defendants. As I understand your argument, it's almost like it's manyfold, but primarily your brief says, look, Padilla did not undermine Duane Mala. Padilla's Sixth Amendment, Duane Mala's Fifth Amendment due process, etc. That Duane Mala is not unsound in principle, and Duane Mala is not unworkable. And that's what you do for stare decisis analysis, that you stay with the plain language of the statute and not overrule Duane Mala. But that's what I understand your argument to be. I want to focus on the am I correct that in a broad brush that's your argument, or am I painting too broad a brush
no,
that you feel comfortable
no,
with?
No, Justice, you got it.
Okay. I want to focus on the Padilla's effect on Duane Mala. Sixth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, different remedies, right? One is withdrawal of a plea, the other is ineffective assistance of counsel. Okay. Padilla's ineffective assistance of counsel. The state is advancing that Padilla change in law undermines the rationale for Duane Mala, and therefore it should be, is one of the reasons it should be overruled. How does a request to overrule Duane Mala affect pro se defendants? Given that Padilla is based on ineffective assistance of counsel and pro se defendants won't have counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are able to advance any comments regarding that.
Yeah, Duane Mala and 97108 especially has a particular, I think, importance in pro se cases where they haven't had a chance to explore all of these options before coming into courtrooms. And so, of course, if they haven't been represented by counsel, it would have Padilla would have no effect whatsoever on the underpinnings of 97108 for pro se respondents. So I think their argument is premised on the idea that all defendants are going to have an attorney, and that they're not going to and that therefore, because they have an attorney, they're not going to need an advisal like the one written in 97108 quite as much. And of course, I would say that the pro se candidates are a good reason why defendants are a great reason why the court continues to be so important in advising all defendants about the immigration consequences of the conviction.
Counsel, how precise does the recitation of the warning have to be?
I don't think it certainly doesn't have to be perfect. I think that the matter of the State versus Mersal case that was decided in the Court of Appeals below, and Fuerte Reyes in the court below, I think that the court really gets at substantial compliance pretty well. I think 2 out of 3 is not good enough.
And why is 2 out of 3 not good enough in this context, given that the omitted element had nothing to do with his exposure to removal?
Because the way I frame the two separate elements of the 97108 sub 2 motion is that you don't need a causal nexus with the particular consequence, the naturalization in this case, in order to show that the judge failed to deliver an adequate advisal.
And is that because of the interorum effect of the three elements, or is there some other reason?
Well, I think the three elements do capture pretty well a breadth of consequences. So naturalization is a great way to signal to defendants who already have their green card, for instance, that even they could face consequences. You know, they're not necessarily afraid of the same deportation consequences that someone who's here unlawfully might be afraid of. So I think all three must be mentioned, because for all defendants, you need to cover a lot of bases there.
Okay, and let's say that's generally true as a policy matter, and that's what the legislature intended. But in practice, if the omitted element had nothing to do with the exposure to removal, then what harm has Mr. Fuerte sustained?
Well,
is in forecasting this, Is it because the point of the warning is to scare the defendant enough that he contemplates not doing the plea?
I mean, I think that is exactly the point of the advisal itself. And what harm an individual suffers as a result of the omission of a single word or a single phrase is really hard to get at. And that's one of the reasons why I would caution against an application of the harmless error rule 297108 sub 2 motions in the first place, because of that factual inquiry. And you'd have to say, and I see that my time is up, Justice Kelly, but
please briefly
wrap up. I think if you had to get at which of the words that was omitted actually was what pushed the defendant over the line and decided not to throw up his hands and withdraw his plea right there in the hearing, I think that you'd have a really challenging burden. And I think that's one of the elegance of such a simple motion crafted by the state legislature here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you really conceding that there was not substantial compliance with the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. We conceded that under the current case law, there was not substantial compliance with the statute. The Court of Appeals has been pretty clear that omitting one of the three consequences under the statute has not been considered substantial compliance.
And you don't believe you can argue against a Court of Appeals decision before this Court, right?
Well, we admitted in our brief that the Court had not substantially complied with the statute. Obviously, if this Court decides that that was foolish, it can do so. And we're simply following the Mersall decision, which considered this very thing and said very small deviations from the statutory language are considered substantial compliance, but you can't do something like omit one of the three consequences, and that's why the state conceded that.
Well, let's say, which is true, and as the Chief Justice just alluded to, you can argue before this Court that Court of Appeals decisions are wrong, and we have the power to say that they are wrong. Do you still concede under those parameters and assumptions? Would you still concede that there was not substantial compliance?
No, Justice Gableman. I believe Mr. Reyes-Fuerte has made very clear that he was not. Mr. Reyes-Fuerte has made very clear that he was not subject. He was not contesting naturalization. He was not subject to that consequence at this point in time. And the state would argue that yes, if the court is going to allow that type of harmless error analysis, then any error that the circuit court made below was definitely harmless in this case.
Thank you.
Does that include the non-citizen, non-resident versus citizen-resident discussion?
I think, Justice Bradley, that would require the type of hearing that the state is asking this court to allow us to determine exactly what Reyes-Fuerte knew and what he understood when the court gave him that warning. And in answer to your question earlier, that kind of goes to how I'd like to answer that question. Pro se defendants in Padilla, obviously pro se defendants are at a large disadvantage in many respects, but we almost never have pro se defendants at the plea hearing stage because indigent defendants are entitled to counsel at the plea hearing stage. So it's rarely an issue that someone does not have counsel when they're entering a guilty plea.
Do you know what the standards for indigency are in the state of Wisconsin?
Not precisely, Justice Bradley, I don't. But the flip side of that coin is that if we treat this the same way that we would treat any other plea colloquy claim, pro se defendants are not going to be worse off than any other pro se defendants. Pro se defendants whose circuit court forgets to tell them what the maximum sentence is are going to be in that same type of position. And then they have a very clear remedy. They make a Bangert claim. They point to the plea colloquy and say the circuit court omitted this information and I didn't know it. And then we have a hearing where it's the state's duty to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the person did otherwise know that. And obviously with a pro se defendant, you are not going to have an attorney getting up on the stand and testifying that he told this person everything that he needed to know. And you're going to be in the same situation with a pro se defendant in this situation. There just isn't any logical rationale not to treat this like any other banker.
Well, or under State v. Carter, where the circuit court misinforms the defendant, tells the defendant the incorrect maximum potential prison sentence, but yet the defendant is sentenced to within the actual parameters this court has held, that where the court misstates but does not substantially misstate the actual length of the potential prison sentence, no due process right has been impinged. And so you go beyond the idea of having a hearing to find out what the defendant knew and when he or she knew it, to the idea that they can be misinformed about what the maximum potential penalty is, but we have a holding that says where it is not substantially different from what the actual length of prison is, that no due process right has been implicated.
Exactly, Justice Gableman, and I believe this court reached a very similar conclusion in State versus Taylor as well, where the defendant was misinformed of the potential maximum penalty, and but he was given the actual sentence that he was told he could receive, and this court said, okay, well, yes, that would necessarily be a Bangert violation, but in this situation, there's no due process violation. And I think what we ultimately have to ask here is, what is the purpose of this statute? Is it to subvert the federal immigration laws, or is it to ensure that people are adequately warned that their pleas might carry immigration consequences?
Thank you. Thank you both very much for good arguments in a time a little spirited, more so than perhaps might be something that we generally care for, but you all responded very, very well to our questions. As you can see, this is a significant case for the court. It's significant for the state and for your client, who will be watching to see what we do, and for many other people that stand in the same shoes as your client does. And I think it's that added tag on cases that come before us that cause us, as a court, to feel very strongly about the case. You can tell we were all well prepared with parts that were bothering us or were not bothering us, and you did a great job of answering our questions, and the briefs were very good too. So I thank you both for your participation and your assistance to the court. We are going to adjourn. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are adjourned.